Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a reading presented by the Poetry Reading Series at the College of General Studies and co-sponsored by the BU Center for Interdisciplinary Teaching and Learning and the BU Center for the Humanities. Our speakers are Irish poet Moya Cannon and American poet David Ferry. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Boston University Associate Professor of Humanities, Meg Tyler.
We have quite a pair to read for us tonight. I'm going to introduce them both now, and Moya will read first, and then David will. Moya Cannon is from County Donegal. She now lives in Dublin. Her first collection, Or, won the inaugural Brendan Behan Award, and in 2001, she was the recipient of the Lauren O'Shaughnessy Award. A number of her poems have been set to music, and she has worked with traditional Irish musicians both in the context of performance and of translating Gaelic poems. Her fifth volume of poems, Keats Lives, which is for sale at the desk, cash or check only, takes us much further afield than Cannon's Green Homeland, to the past of Homer or Shakespeare, to the present of the New York public transportation system. Her work revisits places of human savagery and places of human glory. She does what the best lyric poets do. She steps outside the place she is in and looks back at it with a curious and contextualizing eye, ever alert to the history of our woundedness and, in turn, our capacity to wound. Redemption lies in the precise and restrained expression. Just as Moya's eye never turns away from the objects we make and what they reveal to us about ourselves, David Ferry's work takes in what seems to be the whole scope of literary history and how it mirrors our current condition. David is a prize-winning translator and poet. The National Book Award for Poetry and the Ruth Lilly Prize for Poetry are only two of his many accolades. Although Richard Wilbur calls him a poet of human loneliness, he has populated his readers' imaginations with voices from antiquity and beyond. My Gilgamesh, my Virgil, my Horace are all inflected by David's voice. And it's not only the literary past that is colored by his brush. Whenever I cross a river, I think of David's Acheron, David's Styx, David's River Lethe, and all the ways of travel they have taught me. I welcome Moya Cannon.
Thank you, Meg. I would like to say what a great pleasure and honour it is for me to be here this evening to read with David Ferry, who is one of your very, not only one of your senior poets, but one of your best loved poets. And I'd like to thank Meg Tyler for being so kind and accommodating and in organising this, in inviting me here and being so accommodating in every way since. I'm going to start with a very Irish poem. It's called Winter View from Binbrickan. I'm a hill walker. We think we have mountains in Ireland, but we're told that they're only hills, really. But as far as we're concerned, they're mountains. And this was just a winter walk. In the mountaintop stillness, the bog is heather-crusted iron. A high, hidden mountain pond is frozen into zinc riffles. We have tramped across a plateau of frost-smashed quartzite to the summit cairn. Far below, in February light, lakes, bogs, sea inlets, the myriad lives being lived in them, the lives of humans and of trout, of stone chats and of sea sedges, fan out a pallet of hammered silver, grey and silver. In my next life, I'm planning to be an archaeologist. And the one after that, I'm going to be a geologist. And the one after that, I'm going to play the cello. But anyway, this is I'm sort of preoccupied with archaeology, and this is about a wonderful, wonderful exhibition of art which I went to in the British Museum a couple of years ago, And one of the exhibits was from a lake in Siberia, and was two beautiful little mammoth ivory swan pendants. And I'm always very interested in the fact that as far as we can go back with humanity, we've been interested in beauty. Somehow it has been important to us. These were 20,000 years old. Two ivory swans fly across a display case as they flew across Siberian tundra 20,000 years ago, heralding Seoul on an inland sea, their wings, their necks, stretched, vulnerable, magnificent. Their whooping set off a harmonic, and someone who looked up registered the image of the journeying birds and, with a hunter-gatherer's hand, carved tiny white likenesses from the tip of the tusk of the great land mammal, wore them for a while, traded or gifted them, before they were dropped down time's echoing chute to emerge strong-winged, whooping, to fly across our time. Another short archaeological poem. It's about a burial in the Ardèche in France, very near where the Chauvet caves are, where we found some of our very earliest paintings. This burial was of a child, 20,000, the same period actually, 20,000 BC. And I was just struck by the tenderness of it, really. Burial Ardèche, 20,000 BC. No bear or lion ever raked him up. The five-year-old child, victim of illness, accident, or sacrifice. Buried in a cave floor, high above a white-walled roaring gorge, shortly after the ice sheets had retreated. Someone sprinkled his grave with red ochre. Someone tied a seashell around his neck. Someone placed a few flint blades by his side. And under his head, someone laid the dried tail of a fox, perhaps a white fox. Primavera. I used to spend, in the last number of years, I spent quite a bit of time in the foothills of the Alps, the Vosges Mountains near it. And I was there one time at the beginning of February, and I saw some primroses coming up through the snow, and I remembered that it was St. Bridget's Eve. And this was sort of an important festival when we were children, because my father used to bring in a bunch of rushes, and it was a little ritual as he came in. He used to say in Irish, he used to knock on the door, and he had a little prayer, really. And then we used to make these Bridget's crosses. And I was just wondering about this, and about another tradition which they have in the Aran Islands, where the little girls go from door to door bringing a little straw doll. Primavera. A first sighting, five low primroses, and later, near the compost, a sliver of white amongst clumped shoots. A snowdrop splits its green sheath, and high birdsong in the hazels, a jolt to realise that here too, below snow-shawled Alps, with their tunnels and ski stations, this is St. Bridget's Eve. This is the evening when my father used to knock three times on the scullery door and wait for an invitation to enter with a bundle of cut rushes, saying, Chegi Arunglona, Fosklegi Warsugla, Agus Ligigi Ishtach Bridge, which translated is, go on your knees, open your eyes, and allow Bridget to come in. Older, he told me, his sisters used Vi to be the one to knock three times before entering with the first greening. What ritual were they reenacting? Or we, in the warm yellow kitchen, suddenly full of rushes and scissors and coloured wool ends? What ceremony were we weaving there, folding the silky stalks into crosses to hang above the door of each room in the house? Or what do those little island girls celebrate, who still carry the bree dog, the spring doll, from house to welcoming house? If not the joyful return of the bride of Hades after 3 months of deep wintering, if not a first sighting of Persephone, among the rushes in a wet western field. And what caution was told in the hesitation, until that third knock granted admission. What fear of deception, of late frosts, of February snow and dead lambs. Our fears are different now, of floods and fast-calving glaciers, of birds and beasts and fish and flowers forever lost, and the earth's old bones pressed for oil. But our bones still bid her welcome when she knocks three times, when she enters ever young, saying, "Kneel down, open your eyes, and allow spring to come in." It's time for an American poem or two. This is Flycatcher. I'm very interested in migration and how some birds can live in one spot and others need to travel vast distances just to survive. And this is just yet another bird migration poem. Last month, Doris, the bird bander, told us about a one-legged bird, a flycatcher, who traced the spine of the Appalachians year after year and flew south, balancing her tiny, tattered body down through Mexico, all the way to South America, and back to the same Philadelphia hedgerow, to draw breath among catbirds and orioles, to be caught in the same birder's net, to raise brood after brood, and then to balance on a twig, on her single fettered leg, to feed on passing insects, to store fat for her next odyssey. Life can be so rough, yet we can't get enough of it. And this poem was a gift from a wonderful man whom I met on the train from Philadelphia to New York. Keats lives on the Amtrak. Today, on the clunking, hissing silver train between Philly and New York, the African-American conductor squeezed himself into the dining car seat opposite, genially excused himself, and when I responded, asked why my novel was full of page markers. "You have it all broken up." And I said that I was teaching it. He leaned forward, smiled, and said, "I'm going to get a T-shirt with Keats Lives on it." This time of year, he gestured towards a window. Trees were blurring into bud. When everything starts coming green again, I always think of him. A thing of beauty is a joy forever. Its loveliness increases. It will never pass into nothingness, but still will keep a bower quiet for us. I told him it was a Dublin taxi driver who first told me that Keats claimed his only certainties were the holiness of the heart's affections and the truth of imagination. He took a ballpoint from the pocket of his uniform jacket, wrote down the quote, asked where it came from, as I had done 2 decades earlier in the back of a taxi, as hundreds had, since the young, sick apothecary penned it to his friend. "That is a bombshell," he said. "I'm going to give that to my little girl tonight, O light-winged dryad." The intercom announced, "Next stop, Trenton," and the steel wheels began their loud, long scream. He hauled himself up out of the seat, smiled again, and, drawing a line across his chest with his thumb, said, "Keats lives." Snow day. Snow, like manna, fell through the night. By my closed window, the cypress's fingers strain under mounds of white. Deep deer tracks pass the front door, halt at the hedge, start again deeper at the other side. Snow fell and fell through the night, feeding our need for silence, for midwinter light, for believing that all can be cleansed, made right. I was born in the northwest of Ireland, and when I was a child, there were lots of little, as you were driving along the road, there were lots of little shrines to the Virgin Mary. I think there had been what was called a Marian year about 2 years before I was born. So there were lots and lots of them with flowers in May, etc. And over time, of course, they fell into decay. But I've noticed in recent years, in the past maybe 20 years in particular, there are new shrines growing up by the road. And they're very often where people have died and people have put little mementos, etc. And some of them are traffic accidents, but some of them are also suicides. And I wrote this after the nephew of a dear friend of mine took his own life. And the church was so full of people. I said, if only this young man knew how well loved he was. In this age of communication, it's extraordinary that we can't let people know. Shrines. You'll find them easily. There are so many. Near roundabouts, by canal locks, by quaysides. Haphazard, passionate, weathered. Like something a bird might build. A demented magpie bringing blue silk flowers. Real red roses. An iron sunflower. A Christmas wreath. Wind chimes. Photographs in cellophane. Angels, angels, angels. And hearts, hearts, hearts. And we know that this is the very place the police fenced off with tape. That a church was jammed with black-clad young people. That under the flowers and chimes is a great boulder of shock with no one to shoulder it away to let grief flow like dense tresses of water over a weir. I was asked a few years ago to participate in a project to commemorate our National Gallery in Dublin, a National Art Gallery. And they asked lots of poets to write something relating to painting. And I thought I'd write this. In fact, I immediately knew what I wanted to write about. One of my very favourite paintings is by the brother of W.B. Yeats, Jack B. Yeats. And it's called The Singing Horseman. And it's of a young countryman riding home on a breezy day. And he's riding this magnificent horse. And actually, this particular painting spent quite a lot of time on Beacon Avenue here in Boston, because it was bought by a man called Jack Sweeney for his wife, Maura McNeil, who was an Irish... She was a folklorist and lived here. It's about how important song is to us. And I think particularly in your late teens and early 20s, it continues to be important, but it explains the world in a magnificent way at that stage, I think. The Singing Horseman. The white horse, with its golden chest and head, is from another world, is kin to wide-winged Pegasus, or to the white horse that carried Ushinov, or to the black mare of Fanud who saved her rider from a demon. But this golden-headed rider is one of us, a young man with a torn red sleeve, jogging home bareback from the races on a breezy summer's evening in Sligo, riding near the rough blue shore, heading north towards Streeta, playing a whistle or singing. And the painter who paints them both is an old man who remembers 100 races, 100 summer's evenings. But how are we, who do not believe in magic steeds? But how are we, who do not believe in magic steeds, to understand this, except to remember the years between 15 and 22, when our spirits strained as a moth's wings strain inside its brown spun prison, when a song, pressed into black vinyl by some Dylan seeking his direction home, or sung by an acquaintance at a party, giving voice to some long-dead passion, released our crumpled spirits, transported us across skies and oceans, and our hands, our heads, were golden. I often thought that Jack Yeats would have been very happy that his painting came to the U.S. because he was crazy about horses of all descriptions. And he, when he went to live in London from Sligo as a young man, Bill Cody's Wild West show was just across the road from him. And because it caused a disturbance in the area, the residents all got free tickets, and nobody else in his family took up the tickets. He went night after night after night. He was great fun. He wrote to his brother, William, in the last, W.B. Yeats, in his last years, and he said, some of you, many of you probably know W.B. Yeats's mother's name was Pollexfen. And Jack B. Yeats was obviously trying to entertain his ailing brother. And he said, you know, he said, I often wondered where the Pollexfens came from originally. He said, our uncle said they were flying tin men from Phoenicia. No, they come from Cornwall, but he thought before that. He said, our old uncle said that before that they were flying tin men for Phoenicia. And he said, but that wasn't good enough for me, he said. So I went searching round in the bight of the Mediterranean, and in a minute I had it, he said. Castor and Pollux, he said, were obviously descended from Pollux, he said. So that makes Helen our great-great-great-great-great-great-grand-aunt, and that makes Zeus our great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, and that should be good enough for any man. On a more serious note, Antrim conversation. I went for a walk with my partner in Antrim, County Antrim, a few years ago, and a beautiful, beautiful September day, and we met an elderly man and fell into conversation with him, and one of those very gentle conversations, and then it took a very strange turn. It's kind of shocking. There's an epigraph from Simone Weil here. She says, pain and suffering are a kind of false currency passed from hand to hand until they meet someone who receives them but does not pass them on. So Antrim conversation. Chalk is stained brown near the waterfall. It crumbles away easily as flint nodules are prized free. The flint itself is poised to split into slivers, a suggestion of blades, a memory of the trade this sharp wealth engendered. The small, tidy man who paused on his stick to talk to us in the lane, on this Sunday of rose hips and blackberries, had a voice as soft as chalk. He spoke first of weather and houses and sheep, of a life working to put wee shoes on wee feet, and we talked on and on in September sunshine, until nodules of hurt washed out in the stream of his words. He spoke of being shaken awake as a child by uniformed men with guns, of his own young son beaten up, of prison, of not knuckling under, and then of his satisfaction on hearing a man's head had been blown off in a neighbouring town. History's hard cart rattled on, as flint nodules shattered into narrow weapons. We wondered, dumb, what shift of bedrock, what metamorphosis might heal such wounded, wounding ground. What do we know of the chalk, the flint of other souls, or of our own, or what might break in us if history's weight pressed heavily down? How do we know that we could hold the pain and not pass on the false and brutal coin? And I'll read a few poems from an earlier collection. Soundpost. It's about a friend who's a musician told me, he was a traditional Irish musician as it happened, and he told me about a friend of his, an old fiddler, who spoke about another fiddler who said he had a fiddle with a very special tone, and the special tone came from the fact that the sound post in the violin, in the fiddle, was made from a bird's bone. So just this is about, I suppose, hidden things that make a difference. Oh yeah, I inquired about this, and while I was writing it, I found that in French, the word for the soundpost is lamb, the soul, and in Italian, the anima, I found very interesting. Soundpost. Its tone came from the soundpost. It was made from a bird's bone. A musician tells of his friend's fiddle, the one on which so many well-shaped tunes had been turned and played. In French, it is called lamb, the instrument's soul. In Cremona, when the master luthier brought a supply of slow-growing timber down from the high Alps to shape around his moulds, it was called l'anima, a round peg of wood,
positioned carefully inside the instrument, almost under the bridge, to hold apart belly and back, to gather every vibration of the strings, every lift and fall of the bower's wrist, to carry all that is in us a flight through the woods of the instrument. In 2006, I was on a flight back from Buenos Aires, a wonderful city of Borges and a wonderful city of bookshops and book lovers. And I was passing over Fortaleza, the north of Brazil, and it just occurred to me that this was a city whose name I had never heard before. And I just began to think of the millions of people just living down there and of the complexity of all of their lives. Just even the, you know, they were putting babies to bed, they were falling in love, they were paying their bills, etc. And I also started to think about, you know, at one of those moments where you realize I'm in a very large, heavy piece of metal high in the sky, and what's holding it up? And that became a metaphor for other things. So this poem is called Hands, and I leave you with it, and thank you very much for listening. It was somewhere over the northeastern coast of Brazil, over Fortaleza, a city of which I know nothing, except that it's full of people, the life of each one a mystery greater than the Amazon. It was there, as the toy plane on the flight monitor nudged over the equator and veered east towards Marrakesh, that I started to think again of hands, of how strange it is that our lives, the life of the red-haired French girl to my left, the life of the Argentinian boy to my right, my life and the lives of all the dozing passengers who are being carried fast in the dark over the darkened Atlantic, all of these lives are now being held in the hands of the pilot, in the consciousness of the pilot. And I think of other hands which can hold our lives, the hands of the surgeon whom I will meet again when I return home, the hands of the black-haired nurse who unwound the birth cord from my neck, the soft hands of my mother, the hands of those others who have loved me, until it seems almost as though this is what a human life is, to be passed from hand to hand, to be borne up improbably over an ocean. Thank you.
I'm going to start with a poem called Who Is It? Here inside this fiction of myself, two voices I always hear, both of them mine, I guess. One of them telling the truth, I guess. I don't know which one it is that's telling the truth. The voice that said what it was, it had to say, and heard what it said when it said it, didn't know exactly what had become of the person who'd said what it was he said just now, to tell the truth. Always like this. Always it's been like this. The one that told my parents who I was, told my wife who I was, told my children, and told whoever it was I was talking to. So help me God, telling the truth, so help me. This is a poem called Everybody's Tree. A storm broke over us on a summer night, all brilliant brilliance and display, and being out dangerously, I thought, on the front porch standing. Over my head, the lightning skidded and blistered, sizzled, and the lightning skated and blistered and sizzled and skidded and yelled in the bursting down around my maybe 14 years old being, and in spite of all the fireworks up above and what you'd thought would have been the heat of all that exuberant rage, the air was suddenly cool and fresh and as peaceable as could be down on the porch, so different from what it was my body was expecting. The raindrops on the front porch railing, arms, peacefully dripped as if they weren't experiencing what was coming down from above them as an outrage. My body could reinterpret it as a blessing, being down there in the cool, beneath the heat. It wasn't, of course, being blessed, but being suddenly singled out with a sense of being a being. Sometime early on in the 19th century, down in the part of New Jersey called New Sweden, someone with a familial link to me, maybe a grandsire down a maternal line, whose name was Isaiah Toy, was sitting up in the house of his dying bachelor uncle, who was also Isaiah Toy. And Isaiah Toy, his uncle, would leave his farm to Isaiah Toy, his nephew, who was sitting in a chair in the next room to where his uncle was dying. I don't know what kind of light it would have been that he was reading the Bible by while his uncle slept towards leaving the farm to him, when suddenly, reading, who was it, Matthew or maybe Mark, the glory of the Lord broke over his head, or so he said. Methodists got excited when, in the woods of their confusion, suddenly the moonlight burst above their heads and they were ever after then enlightened beings. Quote, light suddenly broke upon his mind. For fear of disturbing his dying uncle with his joy, the expression of which he could not repress, he went out of the house into the brilliant moonlight shining upon the snow and gave vent to his feeling, shouting, glory to God, glory to God in the highest. Coming back in from the porch, while the storm went on above our little house, I went to close the window of the dining room that looked out back of the house. I could dimly see, the backs of the Bowden Street houses all in a row, occasionally lit up and washed blank by downpours of the lightning of the storm. The Becker's house, the Giles's house, the Demarest's, Jean Williams's, where she lay in the sleeping sickness, and Bessie Phelps's house, the one next to hers. The property lines of the houses and their yards made briefly clear by the lightning flashing, running along the back of the hither yards, was a tiny ditch defining the property lines between where our Yale Street backyards ended and where the yonder Bowden Street houses backyards backed up to it. My childhood fantasy thought the waterless tiny ditch was the vestige of a mysterious, long ago, bygone, vanished river that came from somewhere else and went somewhere. I don't know. Didn't know, though of course I knew then, whatever went on of these houses, or in my mind, or my mother's mind, or my father's, asleep upstairs, though I kept wondering, and wonder still, what is it they were doing? Who were they? All are gone, the unfamiliar faces. Over beyond in the night there was a houseless, wooded lot next door to Bessie's house. Because of the houselessness and because of the trees, I could think of it as a forest, like the forest in Hawthorne's great short story, Young Goodman Brown. And from out that window, looking out at the back, I could faintly see, or thought I could see, maybe once or twice by a flash, a raining gust of the light of the lightning, the waving tops of trees in that empty wooded lot beyond Bessie's house. The houseless tiny lot seemed like a forest, and in that forest there was a certain tree which all of us children somehow knew was known as everybody's tree. so it was called, though nobody knew who it was who gave it its name. And on the smooth hide of the trunk, there were initials. Nobody knew who it was who had inscribed them. We children had never gathered around that tree to show each other our bodies. I remember how, crossing through that houseless wooded lot on my way home on an autumn afternoon, that strange tree with the writing on it seemed ancient, a totem, a rhapsody playing a music written according to an inscrutable key. How did I ever know what the tree was called? Somebody must have told me. I can't remember. Whoever it was has become a shade imagined from an ancient, unrecoverable past. One of these is a translation by the great Jorge Guillén, who was a wonderful Spanish poet who was teaching at Wellesley when I first started to teach there, and I didn't have any Spanish, and he didn't have any much English, and he was very kind, and he'd heard somehow that I was starting to write poetry, and I'd meet him in the hall sometimes, and he'd say, in his hoarse Spanish voice, he'd say, "Oh, poet!" And so, and that's all we had to say, but it made me feel good. Anyway, this poem by him is absolutely marvelous. It's Unos Caballos, Several Horses. There are several horses grazing in the field, motionless almost, untroubled as the grass, silently growing there in the light of the natural morning before the beginning of anything human. Docile in the confines of the pasture, these hairy, unyoked, idle, quiet creatures in vegetative peacefulness show no sign of understanding. Their shadowed eyes and tranquil ears know nothing of the vigil that they keep. The serenity of heaven is realized in their obliviousness of it, grazing there. And I wrote a poem about horses, partly because of this poem, partly because of a wonderful poem which I brought it with me by my friend the poet Tom Slay, called Three Horses, and partly also because Richard Wilbur had also translated that poem by Guillén, and so because I was scared of his translation, I didn't bring it to compare. But here's my poem. It is true that, as he said, he in that first line is Tom Slay in his poem. It is true that, as he said, the horses, when the lightning signaled something along the horizon, acknowledge the signaling, moving about in extraordinary beauty of shifting, neighing, flicker of ear, changing of pace, slidings, turnings, the delicate legs finding out something the ground could tell them, interpreting the sky's statement of oncoming darkness. The storm was doing whatever it does, matrix of signaling along the horizon. In the valley, the houses were brilliantly clear. The storm's darkness was making possible a perfect delineation, the house's edges brimming with light. And this is another poem by Guillén, which I call In Balance. I forget what I call it. I am so happy. It is wonderful to breathe the air and be in the morning light on a day like this. If the soul weighs anything, it is like the weight of a flower bending itself down to the earth in the weightless light and air. Everything calmly gives itself up to happiness on a day like this. The whiteness of a wall gives whiteness to the eye that looks at it. The grass in the vacant lot across the street yields to the morning breeze that flows across it till the breeze dies down like the end of a sentence spoken. And this is my translation of a poem by Hölderlin, Hälfte des Lebens, half of life. The yellow pear tree bough and the wild rose branches hanging over the quiet waters, and the swans, a little drunken, kiss and kiss again the sacred summer waters. Alas, when winter comes, where will I find such flowers? Where will I find the sunlight and shadow of the summer? The walls are speechless, cold. The weather vane bangs in the wind. So this poem is called October, is relevant still. The day was hot and entirely breathless. The remarkably quiet, remarkably steady leaf fall seemed as if it had no cause at all. The ticking sound of falling leaves was like the ticking sound of gentle rainfall as they gently fell on leaves already fallen, or as when as they passed them in their falling, now and again it happened that one of them touches one or another leaf as yet not falling, still clinging to the idea of being summer, as if the leaves that were falling, but not the day, had read and understood the calendar. And this is called An Autumn Afternoon. The rich fume of autumn rises from the ground in light and odor as the leaves rot marvelously in the hot autumn sun. In the autumn afternoon, what was green is turning to light before my eyes. The hawthorn leaves have not yet fallen away. The squirrels are fat. The winter is coming soon. There's something frantic in bird flight. The shadows of wings print and unprint erratically on the little porch roof that I look out on from my window, as if to keep taking back what had just been said. I want to read a passage from, I think I finished my translation of the Aeneid yesterday and sent it off to the publisher. So, thank you. This is a passage from Book 6. Aeneas and the Sibyl are entering into the underworld as Aeneas is descending into the underworld to find the shade of his father and to have the future prophesied. Then, just before the dawning of the sun, the ground began to shake. The woods began to shiver in all their ridges. There was the sound of howling as of dogs within the shadows as Hecate came near. The Sibyl cries, "Depart, depart, all you who are profane. Depart from here who are unauthorized. And you, Aeneas, unsheathe your sword. Go forward. This is the time to be brave and strong of heart." And saying this in frenzy, she went forward into the mouth of the cave, and he with courage went in with her and followed her footsteps as she went before him into the waiting darkness. You gods who rule the kingdoms of the spirit, you tongueless shades, you phlegethon and chaos, you silence-spreading regions of the dark, By the favor of the gods, may I, unharmed, be teller of the things that I have heard and what is wrapped in the darkness here below. In the lonely gloom of night, two figures walk through the empty rooms of Dis's empty kingdom, as if upon a path beneath the uncertain, meager light of a moon almost not there, at a time when Jupiter has hidden the sky in darkness and black night has taken away from all things all the colors that they had, just at the innermost end of the entrance court, just at the place where Orcus' jaws are open, there's grief. There's unrelenting cares where they have placed their beds. There's ashen-faced disease, sad age. There's fear. There's hunger, begetter of crime. There's destitution, shapes terrible to look at. There's death and his brother, sleep, and guilty desires. And on the other side of the open doors, there's war, dealer of death, and there's the iron cells of the Furies and insane discord with bloody ribbons in her snaky hair. In the midst, there is an enormous shadowy elm tree spreading its arms and false dreams clinging under every single leaf of its foliage, so men say. And there are also many forms of monstrous creatures, centaurs, stabled at the threshold there, and by form Scyllas and Briareus, 100-handed, 50-headed, and the striding, hissing beast of Lerma, and the Chimera breathing fire, and Harpies, Gorgons, and he, the three-bodied shade. Aeneas, trembling, terrified at the sight, unsheathed his sword and turned its edge against them. And he would, had not his sage companion told him that these were bodiless, empty images of life, have slashed at fleeting shadows with his sword. One called Rereading Old Writing. Looking back, the language scribbles. What's hidden, having been said? Almost everything? Thrilling to think there was a secret there somewhere. A bird singing in the heart's forest. Two people sitting by a river. Sunlight, shadow, some pretty trees, death dappling in the flowing water. Beautiful to think about. Romance inscrutable as music. Out of the ground in New Jersey, My mother's voice, toneless, wailing, beseeching, crying out something. A winter vapor out of the urn, rising in the yellow air, an ashy smear on the page. The quiet room floats on the waters, The quiet room floats on the waters, buoyed up gently on the daylight. The branch I can see stirs a little. Nothing to think about. Writing is a way of being happy. What's going to be in this place? A person entering a room, saying something, signaling, writing a formula on a blackboard. Something not to be understood. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a reading featuring Irish poet Moya Cannon and American poet David Ferry. Tonight's event was presented by the Poetry Reading Series at the College of General Studies and co-sponsored by the BU Center for Interdisciplinary Teaching and Learning and the BU Center for the Humanities. Tonight's moderator was Boston University Associate Professor of Humanities, Meg Tyler. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Jeff Turton. The executive director of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydonis. I'm Jack Lepiars. Thanks for joining us.